Hey folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Our guest is Probyn Gregory. We are talking because there is a new reissue of a Brian Wilson album out called Live at the Roxy. It was recorded April 2000, so it's the 25th anniversary of this record. I don't remember when it was originally released. I guess sometime around then. They've reissued it in three configurations, two CDs with 40 tracks, three LPs, I think on red, white, and blue vinyl, 35 tracks, and then for some reason the streaming is only 34 tracks. I don't understand that, but liner notes and bonus tracks and stuff that wasn't on the original, including some tracks not recorded at the Roxy but in shows right during that same time period. So it's interesting to hear Brian's very first forays into kind of his last act, his solo career. Probyn is a super nice guy, great musician. If you look at discogs.com and find his page, there's 185 entries for instrument and performance. He has played on quite a lot of records. He's a multi-instrumentalist, jack of all trades, can play anything and play it well. Just a super musical guy, so he plays on a million records. You may have seen him recently. He just finished a tour with Todd Rundgren, and he just finished another huge tour with Weird Al, where they sold out Madison Square Garden, playing giant venues like that. So he's still playing and still having fun. He's still playing with Al Jardine's band when he can. So you may see Probyn on the road soon. So I feel like we're all still mourning Brian Wilson's death a little bit. Just a huge loss. Just hard to understand guys like him are going to go and not make any more music. It's sad. So I was super happy to get a chance to ask Probyn, a guy who spent so much time with him, you know, just what he was like musically, what he was like personally, what the experience was of trying to bring these songs to a live audience. So if that sounds good to you, I think you'll enjoy this. This is me and Probyn Gregory talking about the late, great Brian Wilson. All right, there's California Girls from this new Live at the Roxy reissue, and joining me on the phone is Probyn Gregory. Probyn, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. How about you?
I'm doing great. I've been enjoying this new re-release. It's an interesting sort of look into the beginning of the 10th chapter of Brian Wilson's life. So is this right? You correct me if this story is wrong. You were friendly with the L.A. band The Wondermans. You were both in bands in the L.A. scene. You ended up joining their band. They played at a Brian Wilson tribute show that Brian attended. He saw the band. He loved the way they sounded. You backed him up over the next few years. And then in around 1999, when he was surprisingly putting together a band to start touring, you guys were sort of the natural core band when he put it together. Is that sort of right?
Yes, that is correct. We were all those things that you say. We were an LA band and happened to be at the right place at the right time when Brian showed up at his own charity benefit show in honor of him. And he came and even played at his own show. And he saw the Wondermans in action. And we were remembered when the time was come. Thanks. I have to give a shout out to Melinda Wilson, without whom we might not have ended up in the Brian Wilson band, but she made sure to remind Brian, hey, remember those guys in LA that you really liked? Because they were living in St. Charles, Illinois at that point.
Oh, I did not know that. That's an interesting piece of the story. So did he offer you guys jobs or did you have to audition?
Well, we were flown out to St. Charles and we played. The MD at the time was Joe Thomas. And we didn't actually see Brian for the first day or two that we were there. He was upstairs in the house, and we were down in the basement just rehearsing and meeting the other guys from Chicago, many of whom had played on the Imagination album. And we were invited to come out. There was no technical audition. It wasn't like, well, we want to hear you do Cowgirls, Surfing USA, and maybe Please Let Me Wonder. Nothing like that. It was just we started playing, and we ended up staying there. Then we... Our first show was in March of 1999. I'm probably getting ahead of myself there.
You know, I'm curious. He moved to Illinois because, you know, there's no performer I can think of who's more Los Angeles than Brian Wilson. Was he like a fish out of water in Illinois?
Well, it's a little hard to say. We didn't see his personal doings. I know that he had a house next door to Joe Thomas. As far as I remember, the wives were quite good friends, which is one of the reasons that they wanted to be in closer contact. And he was only there for a couple of years and then did move back, of course, to Beverly Hills, where he stayed until he passed away.
So he's such a complex and interesting and talented person. So I hope our chat today, we can sort of understand what he was like. He would have been, I think, 56 or 57, which is, you know, a pretty young guy. What was his state of mind like in those days? Was he, you know, was he alert? Was he with it? Was he excited?
He was nervous and a little fragile. I will say that when we were just, you know, shooting the breeze in some of the rehearsals, he heard us mentioning some songs, and he said, "Those songs that you're talking about, Heroes and Villains, Surf's Up, can you please not bring those up? It reminds me of a bad time in my life, so just don't even say those titles around me." Hmm. And we, of course, acquiesced. How can you not? And eventually, over the next couple of years, at one point at Christmas party at Scott Bennett's house, Brian was at the piano, and he started playing Heroes and Villains, and we heard this from the next room, and we all rushed over and joined in as sort of best we could. And that was sort of the beginning of breaking the ice to getting at this smile material that was, again, had reminded him of a bad time in his life.
Yeah, over the course of you being in this band, he obviously got way over those interesting negative associations.
Mm-hmm.
So on this new reissue, he really seems to appreciate the band. It seems real genuine. Was he expressive to you guys about that appreciation?
Yes, as much as he can be. Brian was generally a man of few words. You couldn't get him to be very effusive, as many interviewers found to their chagrin. But he was very genuine, and he was a special guy. Very lovable. And he would accept a back rub at any time.
Okay. I can just imagine probing you're in your back of your parents' station wagon or something, listening to the Beach Boys, and then 20 years later you're on stage with him, and it must have been a little bit mind-blowing. Did you was it hard to keep it together, or did you very quickly just become acclimated to, oh yeah, we're in Brian Wilson's band?
It did take a while. I remember that those first weeks when we were in St. Charles, I had to play through whatever amp was there, and the amp that was given me said right on it, stenciled, Al Jardine. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm playing through Beach Boys equipment here? This is the sacred ground I'm treading here. I was a little bit nervous. It took me a while. I never took anything for granted with the band, because you never knew which famous person you were going to see meet Brian for the first time. I mean, I was there when Pete Townshend met him for the first time. He was on his knees.
Yeah.
It's always been special, and I've never taken that for granted. We were the Wonderments guys, and all of us in the band were very honored and fortunate to be in the right place at the right time.
He was such a gifted arranger, and just the way he heard melodies and stuff and the way he set them off against his chord progressions. Did he still have that gift? Was that still evident?
Yes. One of the things that's been a hallmark of Brian up until the last year or not quite year of his life was that he was addicted to the piano. If you were on tour and you were passing by his dressing room and it wasn't showtime, and it wasn't food time, he was extremely likely to be at the piano noodling around, even just playing, you know, Rhapsody in Blue, or maybe working on some new tune, or revisiting a long snippet of Shortening Bread, which is a tune that he loved to play endlessly in a loop, or other tunes. We did an old, I think it was Jimmy Rogers tune called Honeycomb that he wanted to record. Anyway, he and the piano were particular good buddies.
Yeah. So what were the expectations? I mean, I'm guessing it got much bigger than anyone anticipated, you know, like as you referred to doing Smile and Pet Sounds and all that stuff, and it went on for so long. But right when it began, what were they saying the plan was?
The plan. There wasn't really a plan other than we were trying to get Brian out on the road, which luckily did happen. I remember that some of the crew were not so sure, just because he was a fairly fragile emotionally. I believe it was our second show in, maybe that was Milwaukee. He had one of those days where he was hearing the audio hallucinations particularly loudly, and he had the venue hire two armed security guards to stand on either the left and the right side of the stage in case someone drew a weapon and fired at Brian. He was afraid of that. Not all the time, but enough to, that happened on more than one occasion that we had hired security because of Brian's premonitions, which luckily turned out to be false.
Well, that's wild. I saw many times over the years, the band was always stellar, and I mean every single time, amazing band doing these complex arrangements. But for Brian's performances, there were nights when he was sometimes better, sometimes not as engaged. Do you think it was down to things like, just to put it in a nutshell, his mood, what we would call, or was it his meds or outside stimulus? Was he, was he upset about the news or politics or stuff? What did it come down to, you think, for his performance?
It's very hard to say what was going on in his mind. He certainly was on meds to try to even out his, I won't call them hallucinatory tendencies, because these things would come and go, these phases of hearing the voices and being in a sort of in a distant universe of his own, sometimes threatening, sometimes not. So he did have several different sort of medical cocktails over the years. They tweaked his meds. He was under regular reevaluation because they wanted to get him to be with as much clarity as he could have. But there was never an obvious trigger to any of these moods. It wasn't like, oh, if he gets up and he doesn't have his orange juice, he goes into some kind of thing. It's nothing like that. And I wasn't party to any of the meds. I don't know which ones he was taking. I just know that they were under review on a regular cycle and they changed over time. I guess that sort of answers your question.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot to deal with for guys in a band, just to kind of, not know exactly which Brian you're going to have to deal with that night. It's interesting to me when he started touring, the Mike Love version of the Beach Boys were, I think, a little bit ragged, meaning some of their live arrangements maybe had strayed away from the recordings. And then you guys always seem to prioritize playing all of the complex parts and all of the little arrangement bits that were so important to those recordings. How hard was it to figure out what was going on the recordings, and how hard was it to figure out how much of that, what the best way to present those things live? Because sometimes you can't duplicate it, or you don't even want to. You want to make something that has a little more energy than some of the records. How hard was that to do, and what part did you play in that process? Or each of the guy in the band, what part did they play in that?
Well, I hear what you're saying about that. Some of the parts were pretty hard. Luckily, all of us in the band were dedicated to trying to present the music as honest and as faithful a manner as we could. I mean, if we could make it sound like the record, like Nick Walusko, the other guitar player, and myself would listen to the recordings and go, that sounds like a jazz master through like a Fender Twin with the reverb on 3. Or we'd sort of go to the amps and the guitars and try to make the tones match that. We were already doing that in the Wonderments anyway, and other people in the band were also similarly, focused on trying to emulate the sounds that we heard on the records, knowing that, of course, A, we weren't the Wrecking Crew. B, we weren't at Gold Star Studios 1965 with that particular reverb that we... sure, they make reverb units, but it doesn't sound like the Gold Star echo chamber. Anyway, we did as much as we could. Sometimes we'd need help from other guys. Darian was fairly critical to this. He had a really great ear, especially about vocals. He would make a lot of the vocal breakdowns, even though Paul Mertens was the music director at that time. Darian was sort of like the vocals music director and later on became the regular music director, as he is now under the Al Jardine Pet Sounds Band, which is essentially the remains of the Brian Wilson Band now that Brian has passed on.
I think there were 11 or 12 or 13 voices sometimes in that band all singing at once. It's a pretty mind-blowing, which I guess you need, because a lot of the Beach Boys harmonies were multi-tracked. They doubled and tripled themselves. It's hard to imagine the level of accuracy that you had to get one part in the exact right place. And was Brian a stickler for that? Could he still hear those close distinctions?
Brian was, it wasn't that he didn't care, but he was less involved in trying to get us to do the things that, for instance, I've heard on tapes over the years. You know, you hear Brian in the studio going, like on Please Let Me Wonder, oh, is that the best you can do? Dennis, you were a little flat. Mike, you came in late on that one thing. Like he was like a warrior about that in the old days. And that was less the case in 1999 and thereafter. But we held ourselves, the band held ourselves to a higher standard. One of the hardest things to do in that band was to do what I called micro-tuning, meaning that, as you say, because there were so many singers, a lot of us were doubled, which is great. It gives more of the sound like on the record when the Beach Boys were doubled. But it also meant that if I was listening, say, across the stage to, let's just say it was Taylor Mills and I were happened to be doubling at that part, we would listen to each other very carefully. And in the in-ear monitors, we would have each other on that song put up the volume a little bit higher so that we could make sure that we were in tune and that our rhythms were matching. And sometimes you'd have to give a little on, say, my end. Sometimes I'd have to, it rarely came down that I would say, hey, Taylor, can you like come in, like, give a lazy entry on bar three or line number three? It rarely came down to that, but that was hard work, really focusing on someone else's vocal and trying to match it identically from across the stage with all the rest of the band playing and singing at the same time.
Yeah, I can absolutely imagine that it was. Let me remind folks that Proben Gregory is our guest today, and we're talking about this new Brian Wilson reissue live at the Roxy Theater and about his legacy and just about the whole experience, Proben, that you've gone through. Proben, was your job to like do... Did each kind of have a job, like you're going to do the Al parts, you're going to do the Carl parts, you're going to do Mike's parts, you're going to do Brian's parts? Did you have a specific kind of thing that you tried to cover?
Not really. Because of Darian's good ear, he was able to hear the vocal parts. And even though in a particular song, I might be in what would be the Carl part, a little bit higher than certainly the Mike and possibly the Al. By the way, let's not forget that Bruce Johnston was assigned by Brian sometimes to do extremely high vocal parts, like on Cotton Fields. He'd do something that was like in the stratosphere, very squeaky. So it changed from song to song. Whatever got the best blend, and we'd swap parts around until we, in the room off mic, got a good blend, and then we'd stick with those parts. I never could sing the bass parts of Mike, so that was out. But between, say, Nelson Bragg and Nick Wolusko, those were generally the guys covering the bottom, bo-bo-do-do, or whatever was happening. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, not a doo-wop like that, but yeah, we switched around, and Darian was generally the architect of that.
Let's talk about the Beach Boys' 50th anniversary reunion tour, which was phenomenal. The set list was deep. It was long show. You know, it had a break in the middle. Did you ever imagine that was going to happen? And tell me about the vibe in the room when you guys first started rehearsals, because you were combining sort of part of Brian's band and part of Mike's band. And I thought the results were fantastic. Do you agree? And what was the vibe like?
I do. I mean, that came out of the blue. The Beach Boys 50, I didn't see coming until suddenly it was beyond the proposal stage and the band was being asked to hold dates. And I remember those first rehearsals like it was yesterday because, wow, I got to say, as a Beach Boys fan, and you're in the room and they start singing and it's the as many of the original voices as are still alive. You know, Dennis and Carl had passed, but there's Brian, there's Al, there's Bruce, there's Mike. I mean, when they sang together, it was that sound. Like us and the Brian Wilson band, we could sing okay in all humility, but we weren't the Beach Boys. We didn't have that tone, those sounds resonating together. And to hear them in the mix with me, it made my hair stand up on the back of my neck. It was electrifying.
Yeah, I agree. There really was something about those guys, even though they were old and they sounded a little bit older, there was still something undeniable about the blend those guys had together, and it was still very much happening. And I'm sure it must have been really fun to be a part of. I imagine it was an interesting mix of personalities and egos on that tour. And it's funny because I occasionally find myself defending Mike Love's creative contributions to the Beach Boys, mm-hmm. but his personality, as recently evidenced at Brian's memorial, where Mike acted so inappropriately, it can be hard to deal with, and people are kind of split on that. What was he, and he's been, by the way, charming to me when I've met him, but what's he like 24 hours a day? He seems to be hard to get along with, maybe, is a way to put it?
He's a businessman, first and foremost. He wants the machine to work the right way, and he has a vision. He and his wife, Jackie, that they run the what they call Melico, Michael Edward Love. What's the rest of it? I guess just company. He was fine with us. I have nothing bad to say about Mike. Of course, he's occasionally dug his own grave doing some things that people don't agree with, but you cannot fault his singing, his bass singing, and he's always really in tune. I mean, all of those guys, I don't know how they were like machines back in the 60s. You listen to, again, the just in the recording studio, tossing off some take. I mean, not that they, I shouldn't put it that way, tossing off some take. They were, of course, focusing and trying to do the right thing. But Mike was sort of a private guy on the tour bus. Occasionally he'd join in to a game we had called Snippets, where you sing a little piece of a song, and then you have to guess what song that came from, which was something we used to do on the tour bus a lot. Yeah, as I say, he runs a tight show in charge of the Beach Boys, the current Beach Boys. He has the legal rights via Brother Records to use the words Beach Boys for his touring act, and there must be at least one other Beach Boy present apart from, so in that case, it's Mike and Bruce are in that band, and we had, when Brian was still alive, it was Brian and Al, and also Blondie, who is a sort of a latecomer, but I guess possibly could count under those rules.
Yeah, and David Marks once in a while. Yeah,
that's
I think
David
interesting,
Marks.
Mike. Yeah, Mike is a businessman first and foremost, and I guess you really would never say that about Brian Wilson, right? A businessman first and foremost. Yeah.
No, Brian doesn't care about the business end of things at all.
The Beach Boys and Brian's personal history is so filled with drama and trauma and, you know, being a teenage introvert genius and being in a band with your family and managed by your horrible alcoholic dad and the drugs and Eugene Landy. It's a lot. Mm. Did Brian, you know, you say he kind of didn't talk to you guys, you know, much about stuff, but did you just see what a load, you know, did he carry that load with him every day?
Well, mainly it was the load of the audio hallucinations, and he often seemed sort of sad and not particularly engaged when he's say on the tour bus or just in his dressing room. But of course, then he had people that were what we like to call his handlers. Jeff Foskett occupied that role for a while. Jerry Weiss, a friend, did that. Ray Lawler was, and then we had other people that were over the years that were hired for various tours to be his handler, which meant that you generally were with him in the hotel room and you take care of, or if he felt hungry, he'd order a pizza often late at night. Or if he sometimes couldn't find the air conditioning unit in the middle of the night, if it was things like that, there was someone that was like his close companion. The handler is about as good as a word as I can think of it. It doesn't demean Brian. He's not incapable of, you know, regular activities. It's just that once in a while he would do things that weren't maybe on the up and up, and the handler was there to keep those things from happening or to nip them in the bud.
How fascinating. Yeah, it is, you know, from an audience perspective, it's hard to know what it was like. You know, did he, if he saw you and he hadn't seen you in a few months or whatever, was he like, hey, Proben, how's it going? How's your wife? How's your kids? Did you see this TV show? Was he just regular conversational like that?
Not very conversational, no. You could get him to talk about things that were of interest to him. For instance, he loved a ribeye steak. Or even just talking about the Foster's Freeze, if you were to bring up the anecdote of him hearing Surfer Girl for the first time on the radio, you know, he might be into that. I got him on a baseball jag once talking about Mickey Mantle, who was, I think, his favorite player. And certain music, especially if it was old stuff, you know, girl group. Of course, he loved Be My Baby. That was his favorite song in the world. But he wasn't generally doing the social niceties of, like, how's your family and he was capable of it. He just didn't do it that often.
Yeah. One great thing about the 50th was that, like you said, Al Jardine ended up joining Brian's band, and he's an interesting guy. I've talked to him. Did he sort of help provide a little more of what you were talking about earlier? Like, hey, what guitar did you use? Because his memory seems pretty sharp. Was he able to help the band sort of fill out some of the arrangements or ways you presented the songs?
Not so much. I mean, Al is a... of course, is still sharp and has the best remaining voice of any of the Beach Boys, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
And he likes to play that white Strat, and he has some of the old equipment, but he wasn't necessarily a source of info about the old days. I mean, we try to talk about that stuff, but and it wasn't like he was incapable of it. He just sometimes either wasn't that interested or mainly didn't remember, which, of course, we can't fault anyone for that. You know, there was no one walking around with a list and writing on a piece of paper, okay, on California Girls, they're playing a Dan Electro 12 string through a Vox Super Beetle amp or whatever.
Right. Some nerds 50 years from now are going to be really interested in this. I need to write it down. Yeah.
No one thought about that. Yeah. And who might have known was Chuck Britz, the engineer, but he's passed away now. Although we did manage to get he and his granddaughter came to a show that Brian did in San Francisco pretty early on, I think year 2000. The Wonderments guys, I'm afraid, grilled him with all sorts of questions about the old days, and he was forthcoming at the time. I should have had a tape player going.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned Jeffrey Foskett, because he just passed away recently, and he was a big part of the band. Amazing singer, like really strong, high voice, which that band needed someone to sing that part. And like you said, he was a guy who was kind of glued to Brian's side a lot of the time off the stage. Am I right that he started in like kind of like a surf music cover band?
Well, he started out in Santa Barbara. Jeff did. He was in a group called The Pranks, which included Randell Kirsch, later touring Beach Boy. I don't think he was in a surf cover band. I mean, certainly I have. Once I got in the Brian band, I was a sub member in some of the Beach Boy tribute bands that are out there. The Surf City All-Stars, Surf and Safari, Good Vibrations. They're almost always named after songs. And actually, Jeff helped me get into that world, playing on cruise ships, or sometimes you're just playing at old folks' homes, wherever you can get a gig. But that's a lot of fun. And in that band, in the bands like that, just as a small aside, you are assigned to a part. There's like the Carl part, the Al part, the Mike part, and you just sort of stick to your part song after song. And that generally tends to work out best for people figuring out what the parts are. Chris Farmer, the ex-Beach Boys music director, has a tutorial on the vocal parts, that's a treasured CD of mine.
That's amazing. Yeah, I guess you pick a lane and you stay in it, and then there's less traffic jams with the vocals. Yeah, that makes sense if you don't have time to really sort them out. Yeah, there were nights, especially towards the end, where I thought Brian seemed a little more checked out, and I wondered, like, should this guy be doing this? Like, it almost felt painful to watch him. I wondered if he was being pushed too hard or if it was the opposite, if it was the touring that was keeping him engaged and sort of keeping him healthy and keeping his mind working, you know?
Yes.
Or was it the opposite? Was it taking a toll on him? What do you think?
I don't think it was taking a toll on him. We in the band were pretty sensitive to that, to him being, you know, from the outside, it seems as though there were either managerial or record label forces trying to get him to do something. I don't think that was the case. I think he really enjoyed being on the road. He liked the applause from the audience. He liked seeing new things all the time, not just being sort of stuck in his room or doing the same old, you know, walking around the neighborhood in his gated community in Beverly Hills. It did seem that it was of his own volition, so that it wasn't like someone was saying, we're short on... But they don't think they're ever short on money, because, of course, the publishing alone on Good Vibrations and God Only Knows would probably have him, his children will be put through college. Anyway, I think it was honest. I think he did enjoy being on the road. Now, there will be some people that said that things at home were maybe not going right for him in whatever way that might be, and I certainly won't get into that because that's personal information that I'll, you know, don't want to. There's things about Brian that I'll take to my grave because they either don't make him look particularly good or just seem embarrassing. It's like, why would I say those things publicly? It's no use. Everyone knows that Brian had his challenges and did as best as he could. And he was really a sweet guy. I mean, one time I admired his shirt and he began to take it off. He said, "Here, you take it." And he was going to give me literally the shirt off his back. And I, because he's a bigger guy than me, I said, "Thank you, but I won't fit in it." He said, "Oh, okay." And he began buttoning it up again.
Oh, that's fantastic. Brian did make a bunch of recordings. Did you get to take part in those in the studio with Brian?
Yes, we made a whole bunch of albums, even before the what'll be the artistic highlight of my life, which was being part of the team that put Smile back together when Van Dyke and Brian decided to revisit that in 2004. That was amazing. And then, of course, we did a Christmas album and a Gershwin and a Disney and other various albums over the years. And it was he would generally use our band to be in the studio. I know there are other people that bring in session players only or primarily and then expect the live touring band to learn what the session players have put down. And that was generally not the case with our band.
And did he come alive in the studio?
It depends. Sometimes, yes. There was one time, speaking of coming alive in the studio, I'll never forget coming into a session. And of course, Brian is early as he always was. So he was already there by the time that I arrived on time. And he said, "Proben, drop that guitar and pick this one up." And he pointed at a flat wound Rickenbacker in the corner. So I picked it up and he said, "B major." And I'm like, "Whoa, this is great. I love being ordered around by Brian." So I started B major and finally he called out some chords. He said, "I'm not sure what the next one is." And he went to the piano, he played it. I said, "Okay, that says something diminished." So anyway, we got through the thing, but it was on fire. He had all the parts in his head. He was doling them out one by one, including the vocal part. We got to the vocals and he said, "Okay, the first part goes la 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 la." We're like, "Okay, stop right there. La 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 la. What was the next note? La." So we finally got it all figured out. And then unfortunately Darian and I figured out, "Oh, you know what? This is familiar. I think this is an existing Beach Boys song," which it did turn out to be. It was a Mike and Brian co-write. It might have been The Bells of Paris or something like that. And so we couldn't proceed with the song anymore because it was an existing Beach Boys song. He'd just forgotten. He thought it was new and fresh when in fact it had already been recorded. Oh, well.
Wow.
But it was fantastic to see him in charge and order us around like it was the old days of the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. Did you play on That's Why God Made the Radio on that album?
I did. In fact, on that song, which I thought was a great song, Brian had an idea for a theremin part, which I came in and actually I tried to play it and it was beyond the instrument wouldn't go high enough. So I called up the person that had made it from the schematic because we got the schematic from the original Tannerin. And so he told me how to alter it. I could get an extra fourth out of the instrument up on the top, which I did. And I came in the next day and laid the part down. And unfortunately, it didn't make the final mix. And when I asked Brian about it, he said, Joe's passed away, so we can't have him to ask why this happened anymore. But Joe didn't like it. So the theremin part, which Brian came up with and which I loved, didn't end up on the final record. But on that album, I played some banjo and some guitar, maybe some French horn. I can't remember. I'd have to look at the track listing to see.
Yeah, I agree. That's a fantastic song. I think it holds up. And I was disappointed that Brian didn't sort of keep it in his set after the reunion. There's a lot of guitar chords in that song, like a ton of them.
Sure. Almost as many as This Old World.
Yeah, right.
This Old World, actually, talking about number of chords, I can't remember the exact number, but I'm pretty sure it's when you, the one that kills them all is Jan and Dean's Ride the Wild Surf. That has 37 different chords in it.
Wow, keep you on your toes. Yeah, we're talking to Proben Gregory, multi-instrumentalist. How many instruments have you played with Brian over the years?
Oh, with Brian, probably a dozen. I mean, I'm mainly the guitar player and singer. And then, of course, vocals, French horn on God Only Knows, Tannerin on Good Vibrations, trumpet on Darlin', banjo on Cabin Essence, melodica I would sometimes play, Smile, I played all sorts of things. Dobro, I brought in my tuba. I don't know how many instruments I played over the years, whatever. I tried to play clarinet in one song, and I squeaked too often. I had to give it up.
We're talking about this new release. It's the first release since Brian has passed away. It's the 25th anniversary reissue of Brian Wilson Live at the Roxy Theater. Do you remember the buzz in Los Angeles when Brian was back? Because he was such a legend, sort of a mystery. And I'm sure the anticipation for a real full set from Brian Wilson must have been huge around that time.
Yes. I think my friends in the Los Angeles pop scene were sort of agog that we had landed this completely cherry gig. This little club band from LA is suddenly part of the larger Brian Wilson band. And we did sort of suffer from one thing that happened in the early years, particularly the first year of the band, is that people would refer to Brian's backing band as the Wondermints, which the Wondermints were part of Brian's band, but we weren't all of the band. So it wasn't like the Wondermints were standing there alone. It's like we had the people from Chicago that had played on the Imagination album.
Sometimes people still refer to that. They just say the Wondermints were a great backing band for him. It's kind of one of those things that's never going to get cleared up exactly in history. But I think we know what they mean.
Right. We know what they mean. So, but to answer your question, you know, there was a lot of anticipation around LA, and trying to remember when we didn't actually play in LA for quite a while. Our first dates were in the Midwest. Then we did some East Coast things before going to Japan in July of 1999. God, maybe the Roxy. Maybe that was our first LA show. I'd have to look that up.
You know, a lot of years went by, and we talked about in the beginning how he was nervous, fragile. It did seem like he evolved over the course of the time that you were with him, you know? Did you feel that? And did that sort of feel good to see him sort of maybe come out of his shell a little bit?
Yes, it was incremental. There was never a time when you could say between days of the week that there was a measurable difference. And because, of course, is because of the audio hallucinations, which would come and go pretty much at will, notwithstanding his meds that he was on, things would just happen to him. But I feel like he did come out of his shell a little bit, certainly with us on the tour bus, although he would generally have his own tour bus that certain people would, like Paul Mertens or later Polandi, would tend to get on that bus, because when at the end of the show, Brian would want to go right away and on the bus and on to the next town. And the band was, we would have our friends that we'd be seeing after the show. There was a time when you'd do after shows, but Brian was not that much into dealing with the public. It actually made him uncomfortable most of the time.
One other thing about Brian is that he was so perfectly frank. And I think in some ways that was just his coping mechanism. You know, if you asked him a question, interviewers, or just, you know, just the times I met him backstage, he would just answer immediately and completely honestly. And it was kind of disarming in a way. And sometimes I think he would maybe dig a little bit of a hole for himself.
Yes, that's true.
Interesting, though, for you to have to deal with a guy like that, but refreshing in a way.
Yes, he was definitely honest. I mean, whatever he said, he meant it. There was no caginess or some hidden agenda behind what he was saying. And once in a while, he would, make a fool of himself with an interviewer. I saw him once in an interview do a very smart thing. It was, I think, a fairly longish interview. I don't know why I was even nearby. But I saw him at one point. A question was asked. He didn't answer. He just looked. He sort of turned his head and looked at the wall. And so without a word, if he got what he wanted, which is the interviewer, after a minute or two, said, "Okay, well, I guess that's it for this interview." It's without even saying, "Can we wrap this up?" or "I'm tired." Or he just sort of stopped answering and looked at the wall, and the guy eventually went away, the interviewer.
Wow. Yeah, I did see him sort of just kind of shake people's hands and sort of get up and walk away. You know, like, "I'm done, thank you, goodbye. I want to go eat a cheeseburger," or whatever. He seemed to me in public anyway, often to be trying to, and I may have this wrong, but it seemed to me that sometimes during concerts, he would be reading prompts to the audience off a teleprompter, like "thank you very much" even would be on a teleprompter.
Right.
So it's hard to know who the real guy was, you know what I mean? And you were in his life for the last 25 years. So to you, who was Brian Wilson?
Well, Brian Wilson was if I had to say in a few words, he was a conduit to God. I mean, the music that came through him, and it's just amazing. He has affected so many people, myself included. I mean, I have spent innumerable songs worth of tears that he has made me happy tears, tears of joy, just listening to his music and getting that sense of mournfulness and yearning that was in a lot of the music, even in something as supposedly bright and up-tempo as California Girls. There's something in the back of it that is, it's not sad, it's emotional. He's feeling it. And because of the lyric nature, the whole Pet Sounds album, the coming of age of a teenage boy, I heard that right when that was happening to me. So it was very meaningful, and it has been meaningful for a lot of people to have his music be a part of their life. And I was very honored to have been part of his final renaissance, being part of the Brian Wilson Band that helped him bring more joy into the world, and some very deep songs. Midnight's Another Day, fantastic song. I'm so proud to be part of that.
Yeah, and as an audience member, I'm so thankful that he was able to get out there and you guys were able to support him and sort of bring that music to the public. I agree. It's you can't even calculate, you know, how talented and wonderful and just important his music was. Let's hear, I thought we could end up with hearing Love and Mercy from this new album, which has just been re-released, called Brian Wilson Live at the Roxy Theater. It's the 25th anniversary of the recording of this. Was that sort of an important song?
Yes, we actually used to end our shows with that for many years. It would be the final song that we did. It had the right lyric sentiment, and it was honest, straightforward, direct, not melodramatic, not maudlin, but it's believable. And I think that the music speaks, once again, right to the heart. It may not be one of his better known songs, but I think it was an important song for Brian, which is why we ended up finishing the show with it all those times.
Yeah. All right. Probin Gregory, thank you so much for visiting with us and giving us just invaluable insight into one of the most important music makers ever, I think.
I think so too. Thank you for spending the time with me today.
I was sitting in a crummy movie with my hands on my chin. Oh, the violence that occurred seemed like we never...
Were you nervous at all when you started the show?
Oh, I was very nervous. Yeah, I had butterflies in my stomach. As soon as the first chord of the first song started, I felt okay. I was like, that was cool.
Are there any particular songs that you were especially proud of or that you were really happy with the way it turned out?
California Girls was a very, very favorite of that night in the show. I love that song, California Girls. It was very interesting.
How did you feel hearing the tapes back when you were mixing it and putting it together?
It was pretty nostalgic. I felt kind of sentimental about it, you know.
Tell me about the vibe that you get with the members of the band.
Oh, I get so much security from them, you know. You can never guess. Jeff has got to be the best band leader I've ever known. Except for Carl. He's got to be the best band leader I've ever known. The Wondermans are the greatest group I've ever known, you know. But they're all great musicians. They all sing great. Probin is the most excellent trumpet player I've ever heard. His trumpet is unbelievable, and he sings like an angel. The guy is absolutely great.
Would these guys have been pretty good back in the 60s?
Oh, they'd have been great. Are you kidding? They'd have been fantastic. Why couldn't we have done it in the 60s, you know? Why not?
Do you have anything else that you'd like people who are buying the record to know about it?
Well, I hope they enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed doing it, because we really got off heavy on it, you know. It was great.